This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Oh, my goodness, Dave. Dave, is that the sunshine? Is it still shining out there? It's hard to imagine. I had to clear my eyes. Wow, what a long, miserable month this has been. it's a busy one, too. When it comes to psychology-related issues, of course, our guest today on Target is the president of the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador, Dr. Janine Hubbard. Hello.
Good afternoon. I'm jealous. I'm in a windowless office. Maybe it's better I don't know there's sunshine.
Oh, well, I can see it over Dave's shoulder through four or five panes, separate panes of glass.
Well, there
but
you
I
go.
Can still
and if we're
see
in a pinch
it.
And we need to, we can talk about seasonal affective disorder. And
oh, come on with it.
The sun is so important around this time.
Come on with it. I was saying to somebody the other day, you know, I hear so many people say, oh, I love the fall. It's so nice. I love it. And all I can think of is, because I really get down in the fall, really down.
Yep.
So, yeah, definitely more sunshine, the better for me. But it's a busy month.
It
and
is.
This is, for starters, because you reached out to us and you said, by the way.
There's a lot happening.
There's a lot going on, and not the least of which is ADHD Awareness Month.
It is indeed. I have spent two of the last 3 weekends attending virtual ADHD conferences. So I've had a lot of ADHD thrown at me recently, but some really exciting information and some, you know, it's always great to be able to hear, you know, some of the newest and most recent research and some of the things that people are learning. And although I really miss in-person conferences, it has certainly made it a whole lot easier to attend some of the things that I might not otherwise be able to.
For certain. And I remember when you first held that ADHD conference down at the Capitol, I believe
yep.
it was. Oh my goodness, the response was overwhelming.
Well, and that's why I like to highlight it. I mean, I know we have these months and these things every year. But what we know is, well, first of all, ADHD affects about 5% of the population. That's a big chunk. And our understanding of it has just come such leaps and bounds since I started grad school in the mid-90s. Like, our understanding of it, there are so many things that we believed back then. I mean, back then we still thought kids outgrew it. Our understanding of what it looks like in women, our understanding of some of the emotional implications. Like, there's just been so many developments. And yet, it is still something that a lot of people think of as physically hyperactive, misbehaving little boys. And so that's why it's so essential to talk about it every year.
Well, for sure. So I guess we'll go right back to square one, because you and I have discussed this before.
Yep.
People who listen to this show know that. But what is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
Okay. What we know is, first of all, it presents in a wide range of presentations, partly because there are three different subtypes. And within each of those subtypes, some people experience more difficulty in one area than another, or in more severity than another. So, and there's something that used to be called ADD, and we removed that just to confuse people. So, three subtypes. We have the predominantly hyperactive impulsive subtype. That's what people think of when they're thinking of that hyperactive little boy who can't sit still in his seat and, you know, is poking the kid beside him and can't stand in line and is often kind of winding up in hospitals for, you know, literally kind of leaping before they look, not kind of thinking through the consequences. I often kind of describe it as that subtype is the, it seemed like a good idea at the time subtype.
And it's the one, like you say, it's the classic one that people immediately recognize.
Yeah.
You know, you know when you're in a room with somebody who's manifesting in that hyperactive kind of way.
Absolutely. Especially when we're younger, and we'll talk in a couple minutes about how things look when you're older. But those are the kids, and particularly those are the boys that get picked up really early on. Girls may be really hyperactive, but it comes out in different ways. They may be very verbally hyperactive, so they're the chatty Cathys. They're the kids who are interrupting and blurting out, but they may also just be considered the social butterflies. Or they channel it in ways that it's considered more pro-social, but it's still hyperactive behaviors. I think of a great example I had recently, a little girl who, as soon as the teacher was ready to hand things out to the class, would immediately leap up and take them from the teacher to hand them out. Well, that's a behavior that you'd like, oh, well, thank you. Thank you for being so helpful. Meanwhile, that's actually not a behavior that the kid was supposed to engage in, and it was an impulsive, hyperactive behavior, but because it comes out in more of a pro-social way, it doesn't get picked up, or it doesn't get criticized, or it doesn't get the negative attention that it might have in a boy who leapt up because he wanted to go and do something over at his friend's desk. So it looks a little different. So that's a hyperactive impulsive subtype. The next subtype is predominantly inattentive subtype. And that's the daydreamer. That's the difficulty sustaining attention, difficulty maintaining attention. That's the kid you send upstairs to, you know, get their sweater, and you come up 20 minutes later, and, you know, they're reading a book, or they're, you know, playing with their dinkies, and you're thinking, a lot of their behaviors come off as oppositional because it's like, that isn't what I sent you up to do. And really, it's a combination of they got upstairs and couldn't remember what they were supposed to be doing, or got distracted by, oh, look. I mean, again, we kind of joke, it's the, oh, look, shiny object subtype, but it really is. And sometimes it's difficulty maintaining focus. Like I say, sometimes it's difficulty sustaining it. One of the common misperceptions is ADHD is a lack of focus. It's not, actually. It's difficulty regulating your focus. So it's difficulty putting your focus on the thing that you know you're supposed to be focusing on. So either you're distracted by something visually, or, you know, you hear a noise and that's what you're paying attention to. So again, that's the inattentive subtype, formerly called ADD. And then the third subtype is combined. So it has features of both the hyperactivity, impulsivity, and the inattention.
So what causes this? Because I think a lot of people tend to think that, you know, your mind is racing at all times, but really it's quite the opposite.
It is. Well, and first of all, it's really important to know that it is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's not due to bad parenting. It's not due to too much sugar. It's not due to food additives. It has an extremely strong genetic component. So if I'm ever assessing a child and diagnosing ADHD, the very next question is, which one of the parents does your child resemble? Because we know, again, especially in the more inattentive type or in women, kind of generation 30s, 40s, 50s, kids are getting diagnosed now, but parents were missed when they were going through school unless they were extremely hyperactive, impulsive.
Well, yeah, and sometimes you have to look at that report card looking back. She's not really paying attention. She could do so much better if she just applied herself. He wouldn't be so bad if he would just give up talking all the time.
Yep.
You know, those kinds of things.
Would
you
do
can
well
see
if
it.
He remembered to turn in assignments, has difficulty organizing materials, spends too much time socializing. All of those comments. I mean, that's one of the things that we do as part of the diagnosis, is go back and review things like report cards. Now, that being said, if you're really smart and your issues with inattention and you're well-behaved, your report card might not reflect anything. And that's when you need to go and then look at, you know, some of the additional comments, things that are out there. I know I keep coming back to girls and women, but again, they've been so misdiagnosed. And like I say, sometimes the behaviors get channeled in a different way. So I had somebody where, yeah, report cards, other than the odd little bit about, you know, chatting, they were being praised because they were organizing all the school assemblies. They were running around channeling all of this in a pro-social way. So we get, you know, comments like working with a raw energy source. And that's a compliment.
Well, sure. And one of the checklists on the checklist they'll often say appears to be running as if
on a motor.
Yeah. Yeah. Just continually going until, you know, you go to bed.
Yeah. Or the other analogy that I use for a lot of the kids and teens in particular is it's kind of like being a duck or a swan. On the surface, it looks like they're just kind of floating through, but what you're not seeing is the amount of effort, the paddling, the stress that's happening behind the scenes. So, yes, they're doing all of their work, but at what expense? How much effort is being put into it? How much more energy are they having to put in, or how many more hours are they having to put in to get that same level of effort that their classmates are doing far more easily?
And I want to talk a little bit about this neurological disorder, what causes it, and how it can be treated when we come back after the break. My guest today on Target is the president of the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador, Dr. Janine Hubbard. We'll be back right after this.
Join Brian Medore weekdays at noon for a comprehensive update on news from every corner on all levels, newsmakers, weather, and more. Join us on your VOCM at noon.
And our guest today is the president of the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador, Dr. Janine Hubbard, and this is ADHD Awareness Month. And you spoke about how it's a neurological disorder. What causes it? What is going on there?
Well, as we were saying, we know that it has a very strong genetic component. So we know that it's something that you likely inherited from members of your family in the same way you inherit your hair color, in the same way you inherit maybe a tendency towards anxiety. It is something that is passed along through your genes. And what we know, and again, this keeps expanding in our understanding, that kind of at its core, someone with an ADHD brain isn't absorbing or processing enough of the neurotransmitters dopamine and norepinephrine. So you may be producing enough of them, but they're not being absorbed, or sometimes it's you're not producing enough of them. And we do know that if you look at brain studies, that some of the pathways and some of the structures can look very different in an individual with ADHD. Unfortunately, we still can't use that as a diagnostic tool, so we still have to rely on a whole lot of other techniques to come up with the diagnosis. But that's why, in essence, we look at multimodal treatment for it, but at its core, we know it presents with behavioral challenges, but those behavioral challenges are due to lack of neurotransmitters, which is why we then look at medication, which helps to sort of mimic the typical or more normal levels of those neurotransmitters in your brain.
Are the treatments always in terms of drugs?
No, absolutely not. I mean, gold standard treatment is multimodal. So that involves medication is often a significant part of it. We use the analogy, it's like giving my brain glasses. You know, I can see and squint and work really hard, but I do a whole lot better if I'm wearing my glasses. It's the same thing with ADHD. We do know that about 70 to 85% of people really do benefit from the medication. But medication alone is not going to solve things. It's going to help increase the amount of focus. It might help sustain the amount of focus. It might allow you to sit still for a little bit longer. Like, it may help suppress some of those symptoms, but all of the other deficits, all of the other issues are still there. So it requires a lot of behavioral interventions. It needs school interventions. Oftentimes people need workplace accommodations and supports. I mean, a lot of people, I always say you need a really good spouse or a really good admin assistant to help keep you organized and keep you on time. For example, time blindness is a really, really common thing that we see in a lot of people with ADHD. They get involved in something that they're really interested in that's known as hyperfocus, and the next thing you know, it's 3 hours later and you've forgotten to pick the kids up from school, or you've forgotten to put the roast in the oven, and or you're at work and you realize that you've been really focused on this one activity, but you haven't returned any phone calls you were supposed to have made that day. So kind of.
But we all have days. We all have days like that.
We all have days like that. But this is every day, or more days than not. So that's where you start using things like, again, good assistance, but it could be a lot of reminders on your phone. It's timers. It's a lot of pre-planning and structuring and figuring out how am I going to make my day happen. A lot of behavioral supports. And the other thing is there are also a lot of social, emotional, and relationship issues that are more challenging when you have ADHD. So there's often a lot of psychological support to help manage that piece of things.
Yeah, because I would imagine if that's the way you are conducting your day every day, it can get kind of annoying to other people.
Oh, well, no question. Well, and especially if you haven't been diagnosed and don't know how to advocate for yourself. I think we have stats that say, by the age of 10, a child with ADHD has received 10,000 negative messages towards them because it's constantly the, no, don't, stop, why are you doing, like, it's that kind of messaging, which takes its toll. There's no question. Or the other thing is, it's not that people don't want to finish the tasks, even the boring tasks. It's the, I want to do this. I'm possibly developing a secondary anxiety disorder because I'm so stressed that I can't get this stuff done. But my brain isn't letting me shift the attention to do the work that I know I need to be doing. So, yeah, there's a lot of negative self-imagery. One of the classic books on the topic is, you mean I'm not lazy, crazy, or stupid? And people internalize a lot of those kind of thoughts.
Does it cause a problem if left undiagnosed?
Oh, my goodness. Huge issue. And this is where I'm going to talk the doom and gloom, keeping in mind this is undiagnosed, untreated ADHD. Early identified or even late identified but treated, prognosis is very different. But we know that undiagnosed ADHD, you are far more likely to wind up incarcerated, far more likely to wind up with substance use disorder, higher rates of divorce, more difficulties with unemployment or sustaining employment. Interesting, some studies that came out over the last 2 years, if you have untreated ADHD, you have a higher risk of contracting COVID. The list goes on and on and on. Now, that doesn't mean that just because you have ADHD, that is what's going to happen, but you are certainly at a much higher risk.
Well, I suppose because of that impulsivity or failure to plan and those kinds of things.
Yep, absolutely. And the other thing that we know around the substance use is oftentimes people are self-medicating without even realizing that that's what they're doing. But they, you know, are using drugs and alcohol to try to address, you know, some of the challenges that they're having. And then that becomes a whole other self-fulfilling prophecy.
And then that becomes a whole other thing. So yeah. Some people will say, look, I'm not comfortable giving my child these stimulants because that's what they're given most times is stimulants, which seems counterproductive, but is exactly what they need.
Yep.
Can you explain that?
Absolutely. The best analogy that I try to talk to people about is, if you are having to work on a project that requires some major mental effort, like something where you've got to do like a written report or something that you know is going to take all of your focus and concentration, what's the first thing that most of us as adults do? We pour ourselves a cup of coffee or tea, grab a Pepsi. We grab something with some caffeine in it to help us sustain our attention and focus. And it works. Right? What else do we do? We get up and give ourselves little movement breaks because that also helps to keep us focused and attentive. Magnify all of that, and that's what's happening in ADHD. So again, we know that basically an ADHD brain is more inactive or kind of sluggish, and the reason people engage in all those activities, like especially the hyperactive piece, is to try to keep it awake. It's to try to keep yourself awake and on focus and, trying to stay on task. So that's what the medication does, is it actually helps in the same way, but different functions, that your cup of coffee helps you to get through that, you know, really challenging project. And what I would say, and I know it's always very controversial, and I mean, the process of finding the right medication involves a lot of trial and error, and that's something that often frustrates people, because we kind of start you on something very low and slow, try it for a couple weeks. If you're tolerating that, put it up for a couple weeks. Sometimes then decide, well, no, that's not the right one, and then you switch back to another med. So it can often take several months to kind of come up with the right medication and the right dosage. So that can really frustrate people, there's no question. But, you know, there's a lot of myths of, well, it's going to turn my kid into a zombie, or it's going to change their personality. We keep an eye out on growth, especially in really little kids. We keep an eye out on appetite, again, especially in little kids. They often won't eat their lunch, but they'll happily eat, you know, a significant after-school snack and then supper and then a good bedtime snack. And we keep an eye on sleep because we don't want it disrupting sleep. I've had a couple of kids over the years have really weird side effects, like suddenly they got really weepy or really aggressive. We stopped the medication. That's not an acceptable side effect. And again, sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of gastrointestinal distress or some dry mouth or, you know, some minor symptoms. But what we know is the stats of, if you can find a medication that works, like I say, there's a number of different classes, not all of them work for everybody, but the risk factors that come in terms of accidents, in terms of driving accidents, in terms of, like I say, alcohol and substance use in form of self-medication, not to mention the, because of the impulsivity, you often wind up with things like addictions issues, that could be gambling issues, that impulsivity. So we know that, not to mention difficulties with academics, which again can lead on a whole other trajectory. We know that the pros and cons on this one, it's really worth at least giving it a trial and seeing if your child or you are finding a benefit from it. And stick with it long enough to see if you can find something that's going to work, because it really and truly is. It's like giving your brain glasses.
We're overdue for a break, but if you start a child on a medication, does that mean they're going to have to take that medication for the rest of their lives?
Not at all. And we can follow up on how it looks at different life stages if you want when we come back.
Sure. And with that cue, we will go to commercial break. Our guest today on Target is Dr. Janine Hubbard. We'll be back right after this.
Weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9. Jumpstart your day with Jerry Lynn Mackey and Ben Murphy. Newsmakers, traffic, weather, and more during your VOCM morning show.
And we're back. My guest today is Dr. Janine Hubbard with the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador. This is ADHD Awareness Month. It's also Learning Disability Month and a whole host of other things. And I want to talk about those in a moment. But we started talking about medication. How is it managed in later life?
Well, what we know, something that all of us do, regardless of whether you have ADHD or not, is we go into professions that hopefully pull to our strengths and minimize our weaknesses. So once we start to have a bit more choice about what it is we're doing day to day, sometimes we're able to be in situations where we're able to thrive a little bit more. So school is one of those situations where, yes, it's often not the preferred task for a lot of kids. And because one of the things we know about ADHD that's so frustrating, both for individuals and their parents and their teachers, is if it's a topic of interest or something that's exciting to them, they will research every possible known thing on that topic and produce like the most amazing project. But if they're not into it, it's just not happening. It's like pulling teeth. And especially, so whether it's a topic that's not of interest or whether it's something that's really repetitive and boring and mundane, that can be a lot more challenging. So particularly for kids with inattention, you know, it's really important throughout the school year. In contrast, I'll be honest, I've had some of my teenagers who are more hyperactive and impulsive, where honestly, having them on their meds during the summer was way more important, because they were out, you know, dirt biking through the woods with their buddies and jumping off of cliffs and doing all the things that, you know, wind up getting you admitted to the Janeway after accidents. So in that case, that's where they actually needed the support. And again, for some kids, it may be more where they really need it is that after-school hockey practice and hockey game. So really, when we're looking at medication, it's very individualized to the what is it needed for? What are the areas where it's having the benefit? And where are the areas where, you know, maybe it's not so useful? And like I say, as you go through life, we all are involved in different things, different times. Oftentimes, people may decide they really need it to get through university because of the lack of structure, the lack of routine. They may have done okay in high school because it's so much more structured. University, it falls apart. Then they get into a job where it's much more structured and they might be okay. So it's really an individualized plan in terms of what's needed for support.
And to have that support from your family and friends along the way, I'm sure, instead of like, what's the matter with you? Would you just give that up? That kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that big, big understanding of I'm not doing this deliberately. My kid isn't doing this deliberately. You can still get annoyed with the consequences of it, but not remembering not to take it personally. And looking at how can I support you? How can, you know, would it help if I give you a reminder? Would it help if I do such and such? A lot of learning self-advocacy skills, but also learning how your support network can best help you.
Yeah, and I know how much you like to help people. Would you, you know, how about what if you became a paramedic or what if you did this or what, yep. You know, those kinds of things that keep you stimulated and active and busy and helpful.
Yep. Or I know that you really struggle to remember to take your meds. Can I help you set an alarm on your phone or can I just text you a reminder? Like, so, you know, it can be, again, very individualized, or it's the, I know that you find this task incredibly boring. Can I help you break it down into some steps?
I joke, I have a coworker here. I call her my executive brain.
Yep.
She'll say, are you going to call so-and-so? And I'm like, yes. And she said, did you call so-and-so? No.
No.
Are you going to call him now? Here's the phone number. I was like, thank you.
Yes. What about to say? Because one of the things that we haven't really talked about is oftentimes with ADHD, we get these great out-of-the-box, really creative thinkers. I love it. These are the kids, remember, they have difficulty regulating their attention. So it means they're not necessarily paying attention to the teacher at the front of the room, but my God, they have watched a spider build a web, and they've watched all the intricate details, and they've discovered and explored all kinds of interesting information. So very often, individuals with ADHD, again, so long as you have a good support system, are the big idea people. They just need others to help carry out the mundane carry-through piece.
There's a couple other topics I want to touch on. And we're up to a break very shortly, but it's also Learning Disability Month. Do things like ADHD and learning disabilities go hand in hand?
Oh, absolutely. Now, you can have them separately. You can have ADHD without an LD, and you could also have an LD without ADHD, but we know that they very frequently occur together. And oftentimes, when kids are really, really little, we're trying to tease out. Sometimes there's a bit of chicken and egg. You have a kid who's having difficulty learning, and they look inattentive. Well, are they inattentive because they're not understanding what they're learning, or are they struggling with their learning because actually it's ADHD? And if we treat the ADHD, the learning improves, vice versa. We address the LD, and guess what? They no longer look so inattentive. So again, really, really important for early assessment, early diagnosis, and early intervention. And I can't say that enough times, but we can follow up more on this after the break.
Well, I wanted to touch on this too, though, because it's really heartbreaking sometimes to hear some people say, well, you know, back in my day, the teacher was always I always got the strap. I was always been told I was stupid, getting the bang up the side of the head or something. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? You have kinds of things, and you think, oh my goodness, you had ADHD, or you have ADHD.
Yeah.
Nobody knew it at the time. They just thought you were either stupid or not paying attention or lazy or whatever the case may be. Are educators in schools better now at addressing learning disabilities and things like ADHD?
We hope so. My personal bias is there still needs to be a lot more information about all of this in the, you know, in the training curriculum and in the continuing ed. I know, you know, I know they're trying. And part of the issue is the definitions for some of these things keep changing every couple of years. So kind of as our understanding of these disorders changes, you know, a number of things change with it. And sometimes it's hard if that's not an area that you're working in directly to keep up with it. But you touched on such an important point in either an LD or with ADHD, when it's not diagnosed until adulthood, it's really important to work with somebody or to, you know, get some support around that grief process. Because even for people who've been really successful, it's the, oh, but at what cost it took me to get there.
Or what could I have done?
You know, like I just never made it through university. I kept changing majors every semester. I knew I was smart, but I just couldn't do the work. It's often picked up after a divorce or separation. And again, it's those what ifs of what if I had known that going into that relationship and my spouse had been aware of it. And again, I wasn't doing these things deliberately. I mean, there's a huge... on one hand, it's very exciting with the, oh, I understand, like, I get it. Okay, I now understand a lot more about myself. But at the same time, there is a huge grief process that needs to kind of be processed if it is, you know, a later diagnosis.
My guest today on Target is Dr. Janine Hubbard. She's the president of the Association of Psychologists of Newfoundland and Labrador. And when we come back, I know that October also featured OCD Awareness Week. And OCD is something that I think a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about. I want to talk to you a little bit about that when we come back after the break.
Sounds good.
Got plans for midnight? Bring your VOCM along with the best soundtrack for every night anywhere. The VOCM All Night Show, midnight on your VOCM.
And we're back. My guest today is Dr. Janine Hubbard, and we're talking about you, I say to the audience at large. No, so I'm sure there's a lot of people listening today who are saying, oh, gosh, you know, I hear some truth in a lot of this. But we were talking about ADHD because that's ADHD Awareness Month, Learning Disability Month, and OCD Awareness Week also just passed. And I think OCD is something, obsessive compulsive disorder, is something that a lot of people have some misconceptions about. What exactly is OCD?
They absolutely do, which is why I like to highlight it. You're quite right. The name obsessive compulsive disorder, it's one of a number of anxiety disorders, and it's something that kind of comes and goes throughout life. When people are particularly stressed or overtired or unwell, it flares up, and then it might go kind of dormant for a while. We know it affects about 2% of the population. So, you know, it's a significant group. It usually first emerges sometime in childhood or kind of late adolescence. Average onset is about 9 to 10, although when we go back historically, you can usually see some signs and symptoms from much, much, much younger. But it tends to kind of emerge to a stage where it's going to interfere in kind of that tween age period and then kind of the late teens, young adult period. And in its essence, it's made up of the two parts. We have obsessions, which are unwanted, recurrent, persistent, intrusive thoughts, images, or impulses that cause huge amounts of distress. And here's the thing. On one hand, they can be very typical, very normal. And this is why we talk about kind of an OCD continuum and why it's really frustrating when people sort of say, well, I have a little bit of OCD. The difference here is that people know that the thoughts are irrational or that they are thinking about it way too much, or, you know, if they're having kind of some what-if worries, they know that that's not likely something to happen. So that basically they're aware that they're having this irrational thought, but they just can't get rid of it. And then the second part are the compulsions. And, I mean, most, this is what a lot of people think of very stereotypically. So the repetitive behaviors or thoughts that people do in order to kind of reduce the anxiety. And it can be a very specific thing, like, you know, say someone who is feeling a fear of germs, so it's that repeated hand washing. But sometimes it's the, I have to do something completely irrational, or something bad will happen. And it's a general feeling of dread. We don't know exactly what it is. And again, does it make sense for us to wash our hands once after, you know, we've used the washroom? Yes. Does it make sense for us to wash our hands till they are red and bleeding? No. And so, again, it comes down to the degree in which it starts happening. I use bedtime routines as another example because that's a very common thing where we start to see some OCD rituals. And you know what? We all have a bit of a habit and a routine, but can you wash your face and brush your teeth before putting on your pajamas one night and then the next night put on your pajamas and then go and wash your face and brush your teeth? What starts to happen is a really rigid routine that has to happen in the same order, and then it's the, well, we have to arrange the pillows in a certain way, and we have to have, you know, half a glass of water, and so that evening routine to try to reduce anxiety gets longer and longer and longer and longer.
And that's what I was going to ask, because this seems to be, you know, just from an observation standpoint, it seems to be more anxiety driven. In other words, it has to be this way or something bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
Or it has to be this way or I'm just not going to be able to get to sleep, or I'm just not going to be able to go to work today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I say, it is a form of an anxiety disorder. It falls under the umbrella of anxiety disorders. And what you'll often see in hindsight is little kids having just complete meltdowns. And all they can tell you is, it doesn't feel right. They can't tell you how it's supposed to be, but they just know that it's something there isn't right. And what exactly that is hard to say. But yes, all of those compulsions, those repetitive actions or thoughts or behaviors are an attempt to try to reduce the anxiety. Even though you know the anxiety is completely ridiculous, you know that it's not something that's going to happen, but your brain is telling you, you got to do this. Or something bad will happen. The other way I like to describe it, especially when I'm working with kids, is I talk about sticky thoughts. Listen, we all have weird, unusual, intrusive thoughts that pop into our brain from time to time, right? But they pop in and then out they go. In OCD, these intrusive thoughts, and sometimes they often feature either, you know, the child or the adult harming someone, or sometimes they're very violent, sometimes they're, you know, they're really disturbing images of things that they might do or things that they're seeing, and they just get stuck. It's like, I use the analogy, it's like having a basketball net. And in most of us, we hit, the thought goes in, goes out the basket the other end. Here, the bottom of the net is tied up, and those thoughts just keep staying there and staying there and staying there. And they cause huge distress, and oftentimes OCD doesn't get picked up because so much of it is internal. And if what you're struggling with are really distressing, intrusive thoughts, some of them are very religious, sometimes they're very sexual, sometimes they're very violent, and you're a young kid or a teen, you're not going to tell anybody because, A, they might be concerned that you're actually going to carry through on it, but, you know, in your mind, they're going to think that, you know, you're crazy. I mean, we don't like using that word, but that's the fear of a lot of people, so that they often
and because they know themselves. They know themselves. This is wrong.
Yeah.
This is not how I am. So why would you tell somebody I'm thinking these things when you know yourself?
So then you can develop some secondary anxiety about the fact that, so it's amazing the amount of relief I see in my clients on the first session when we do the you have OCD, like we put a name on it and we explain what it is. And even just the, and I start asking questions where they think I'm like psychic because I ask about things like magic numbers and they're like, how do you know about those? Because it's one of the, but just that very first session where we label it and identify it and say, you know, it's not you, it's your OCD, we externalize it. The amount of relief that most people experience then is just tremendous. And the exciting thing, and this is why I encourage people to talk about, this is so treatable. This is incredibly treatable, mostly by cognitive behavioral therapy. Sometimes we need some anti-anxiety medication to go along with it, but this is such a treatable condition.
Is that right? So if you see or diagnose somebody with OCD, does that mean that they can be treated and live relatively free of it for the rest of their lives?
Well,
afterwards?
What we know is, like I say, it's a chronic disease. So what we do is we label it, we learn coping strategies to try to keep it so it's not, I talk about it being the bossy brain, the bossy OCD, so that it's not in charge. But but we also know OCD ebbs and flows over the time. So there are going to be times where it flares up. It's kind of like having asthma. It's a chronic illness. Most of the time, it's probably well managed. Every once in a while, there's a flare up where you might need some additional support, and then it kind of settles back down again.
So I guess the bottom line is that if you notice in your child or in yourself something that you've always known is not quite right, it's always good to talk to somebody about it, I suppose.
Talk about it for sure. I want to give three websites before we run out of time if people are interested in any things we've been talking about today. The first one, in terms of OCD, website, hang on, it's iocdf.org. And it is, and Anxiety Canada also has some nice stuff on OCD, but this one is one of the best I have found in terms of, it's what the International OCD Foundation, I can't remember what the F stands for, but it's got an amazing wealth of information. And for ADHD, there are two Canadian websites I want to send you to. CADAC, which is the one I just attended this weekend, CADDAC, has everything you want to know if you are a parent of a child with ADHD. ADHD, or you are an individual with ADHD, and then CADRA, C-A-D-D-R-A, is the Canadian Professional Organization, but one of the things they have on their website are adult checklists. So if you are wondering as an adult, if maybe this is something that, you know, maybe this is me, I strongly encourage go to the CADRA website, download those questionnaires, fill them in, get a significant other to fill them in, and start the conversation with your family doctor. It is never too late to explore the diagnosis, and oftentimes it explains so many other things.
Dr. Janine Hubbard, thank you very much. Lots there, I know, and we'll talk again very soon, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
Alrighty.